Accession number 29424, Reel 7.
Just in case you worry, Paul Erstreicher, Reel 7.
As a young student in New Zealand, it is through a very lively and creative group of students who were the local student Christian movement that I met Charles Harrison, who was an Anglo-Catholic priest and was virtually the chaplain to the student Christian movement. And I think he was one of the several factors that then led me to become an Anglican, because my parents were Quakers and I was not an Anglican, and but it was at the university that I made this decision. And so I went to see him and asked him to prepare me for confirmation. Now, my pacifism at that stage, I was, I think, 19 or 20. And my pacifism in that case was already well developed. I had already registered as a conscientious objector to military service in New Zealand. So I was quite clear about my pacifism and I didn't need to work it out. Charles Harrison agreed to prepare me for confirmation. And one of the issues that came up between us was indeed pacifism. Is this part of the Christian faith? And he said quite clearly it wasn't. Although he didn't say that you're not allowed to be a Christian pacifist, but he certainly thought the Christian faith did not demand that, and he was able to give me the reasons. He was ordained in England in 1936. 3 years later, the Second World War began. Now, he explained to me in great detail. He said, when the war began, as a young priest, 3 years into ordination, I realized that I had to make a spiritual and moral choice. And it was a three-way choice. I could do what you were doing. I could say, war is devilish, not of God, I won't have anything to do with it, I will become a conscientious objector. Now, being an ordained priest, that would have been very easy for me because the clergy were never forced to go into the military. I could have just kept my hands clean and stayed out of it. The second option was to become a military chaplain and go to war with the others and preach to them and comfort them and all the rest. The third option was to put my priesthood on hold and join up like all the others and fight. Well, given the evil of Hitler and his system, I just couldn't see how you could be a pacifist in that situation and not go into it. But I wasn't prepared to preach to the others and not do the dirty work myself. So I finished up with the third option. I volunteered for the Royal Air Force. I became a fighter pilot. And I finished the war as the wing commander of a station in Scotland. I shot down Germans and I prayed for them as I shot them down. That was my compromise, because every decision would have evolved some kind of compromise, but that was my conscientious decision of what God was calling me to do. And I said, Charles, I can totally respect that. It's not what I would have done, but I can totally respect your doing it. It fits your personality and, you know, this will not alienate us in any way whatever. And he prepared me for confirmation and I was confirmed and everything else. And he remained a friend. But of course, he'd immigrated to New Zealand by this time. I was living in England and we were literally miles apart. And many years passed and we didn't see each other. When he was well into his 80s and very unwell, and I was visiting New Zealand, I rang him up and said, Charles, we haven't met for probably 20 years. It would be lovely to meet. And he agreed. And he said, we will have a sumptuous meal in the most expensive restaurant in Wellington. And I will invite you. but the restaurant is owned by one of our fellow priests, and he will have us as his guests for nothing. So it won't cost us a penny. So we went to this restaurant where normally the owners of Shell and BP and God knows what dine at, sort of costs that no ordinary mortal should pay, and had this very sumptuous meal. And suddenly he dropped his knife and fork in the middle of the meal, fixed me with his glare. He looked extraordinarily like Pope John Paul II. I've always been amazed at the two could have played that part. Looked at me very intently and said, "Paul, I think God wanted us to meet today because I've got a confession to make to you." And I smiled and I said, "Charles, I'm not aware that you owe me a confession about anything, but if that's what you feel, well, go ahead." And he said, "Do you remember with what self-righteousness I explained to you why I joined the Air Force? Well, I wasn't exactly lying. I did work it out for myself that way. But if I had been completely honest with you, I would have told you that my love of flying just got the better of me." Now, he'd carried that with him all those years. And before he died 6 months later, he wanted to tell me that story. Now, this to me illustrates just what we were talking about. There are always factors in our decision-making which, if we're honest with ourselves, are not really the ones we tell the world about. And this was such a good example of it.
Very good example of it, isn't it?
And somebody who was sufficiently sensitive in his conscience to worry about this through a whole generation.
Or perhaps he had come to self-enlightenment even, you know, thinking about that, and particularly, you know, having had that discussion with you, sort of facing up to his motivations, which one sometimes can do in life, can't you?
Yeah.
You go back and think, no, I did that because of... That's very interesting. I know we're going backwards and forwards in time, and this doesn't matter at all, because it brings me to this issue of why you were turned down as being Bishop of, was it Wellington in New Zealand? Because this seems to be where in New Zealand.
Yes, the Bishop of the very place where I had this lovely conversation with Charles Harrison.
Yes, yes.
What happened? It was. This is a story that you can tell at great length and also in brevity, because the brief version is really sufficient to make the point. Old friends of mine in New Zealand who'd been to university with me were pretty fed up in the Diocese of Wellington, which is the capital city of New Zealand, and therefore, you know, prestigious place. They were pretty fed up with a very, very conservative episcopal regime and a diocese which had been run on very conservative lines, and everybody was tired of this state of affairs, and they felt they needed a new broom. And so these people who once had been to university with me and remembered me had the right in the Diocesan Synod of Wellington to propose any Anglican priest as their bishop. This is part of Anglicanism. It doesn't matter where you come from. If you're an Anglican priest, you're theoretically at least entitled to be a bishop anywhere. And so they put forward my name. To my great surprise, they didn't even ask my permission. They just nominated me. And I laughed and I said, well, everybody's forgotten me in New Zealand. I haven't been around for more than 20 years, you know. They won't elect some total stranger like me. And I proved to be right, because they elected somebody else. But then it turned out that this other person, having been elected, turned the job down. So they had to have another electoral process. And this time, a person of much greater importance in the Synod, in fact, somebody who was one of the private secretaries to the New Zealand Prime Minister, decided, well, I'll put Oerstreicher's name forward again. And he ran a real campaign to get me elected. And he put around a lot of material about me. And of course, he didn't inform me that he was going to do this and get my permission. By implication, by getting my permission, I was admitting that if I get elected, I'll come. I won't turn it down like the other chap, because I didn't want a second disappointment. And it took me great difficulty in deciding, yes, I will go. And it's even more difficult for my wife, who didn't really want to go to New Zealand. But in the end, we said, you know, if God is calling me to this, we'll go. And the terrible event happened. With a large majority, this time, I was elected Bishop of Wellington. It was all over the papers in New Zealand and even in the British press. So as far as everybody was concerned, I was the next Bishop of Wellington. And although I'd been very reluctant, you know, once you get elected, you kind of feel, well, this is what God wants me to do, and you even start enjoying the thought. And so, you know, I was all preparing for this great move. And what nobody counted on, and which almost never happens, there is another process in New Zealand by which the other bishops of the other diocese have to approve this election. And if any of them can put up a theological case against the thing, then it has to go to a further judicial process of adjudication. Is this person suitable to be elected? It's a very complicated process of law. It hardly ever happens. I think it's only happened once at the end of the 19th century or something. But anyway, New Zealand at the time had no archbishop because he had just been made Governor General. The first Maori and to become New Zealand Governor General, a close friend of mine, we'd be fellow students, who'd been one of those encouraging me to come. But he was out of it. He couldn't mix in the church affairs as Governor General of New Zealand. And there was only a temporary senior bishop before new archbishop was elected. And he turned out to be a conservative evangelical who just thought somebody who was also a Quaker, that was just outrageous from his point of view. And he wrote a long memorandum saying a Quaker cannot possibly be a bishop in New Zealand. And the whole thing went pear-shaped. And basically, he pushed through a veto which the diocese then wanted to challenge in the courts. And at this point I said, of course I'm not coming to New Zealand under these conditions of controversy. And quite clearly, a formal reason of my Quakerism was given as the reason. The real reason was my theology, my liberalism, my left-wing politics, my pacifism, all the things that some New Zealanders found distasteful, and the Wellington diocese happened to be more radical than the rest and looked forward to those very things which others in New Zealand wanted to prevent and succeeded in preventing. So yes, because on the face of it, because of my Quakerism, but that was only the tip of the iceberg. The real reasons were what I stood for, and they were frankly scared of this person brought up in New Zealand but who hadn't lived there for a long time and was now a sort of a prominent Englishman and a radical one. That seemed too much for them, and thank God it happened that way, because I know today that it wasn't my vocation to be a bishop in New Zealand. The things I went on to do were much more the sort of things that my background and my interests enabled me to do, and I would not have been able to do them. Whereas in New Zealand, I would have had to learn Maori. I would have had to care for a lot of Maori and other clergy. I would have had to go into another sphere, which wasn't really me. It would frankly have been a mistake. I would have made that mistake by accepting it, with good conscience. And this fundamentalist bishop saved me from myself. Many years later, bishops of New Zealand invited me to their conference. And by this time, he'd retired and was also blind. And I took his arm and took him across the road from the meeting to where we were having lunch. And his name was Peter Sutton. And I said, Peter, you probably don't know who's holding your arm. He was really quite blind. It's Paul Oestreicher. And I want to thank you for stopping me from coming to New Zealand. I think he must have thought I was being ironic. He didn't say anything. Because I wasn't being ironic, I meant it. But I doubt whether he saw it that way. I think he thought it was a backhanded, nasty comment. I wasn't trying to be nasty. I really didn't mean to. You know?
So what date would that have been when you could have become bishop?
1985.
And as you say, a lot has happened in your life and career since
then. A great deal, yes. Yes.
Yes, yeah. These different pathways that one takes, or one is, you know, how some are stopped.
That's right. So it was. Yeah. I was stopped for good reasons.
Yes.
For bad reasons, with good results.
Paul, could we now go on to the end of the Soviet Empire? Because you said something very interesting before when talking of South Africa and the changes there. And how, you know, what a mess really the country is today, but nothing like the nothing like Russia. And I wonder if we could talk about this now. You were saying in 1989, when the wall came down, you were in South Africa.
yes, that's right.
Yes.
Well, I mean, my commitment to the anti-apartheid movement had always been great. And when I was invited to come to South Africa again, because I had, this is after the release of Nelson Mandela from prison, when I was invited by the church in South Africa, which meant Desmond Tutu and others, to come and help them, help them to prevent what amounted to a black civil war. Chief Buthelezi, who was one of Margaret Thatcher's favourite blacks, because he opposed the African National Congress, whom Margaret Thatcher regarded as terrorists. And Chief Buthelezi was playing a difficult political game. He was the chief of the Zulus. He had inherited this. He was an Anglican Christian. He wasn't highly intelligent, but he had a sort of natural political cunning. And he felt that he could benefit from world support for what he hoped would be eventually a Zulu kingdom, a separate entity in Natal, which is the part of South Africa that the Zulu people really live in. He had a little, and of course the white government built him up as a little local chieftain and gave him a capital city in Ulundi with a kind of pseudo parliament, and he hoped that he would become the president of a new state in Natal, a Zulu state, and that would have disrupted the unity of South Africa completely. And the ANC was opposed to it, and the Inkatha party of Buthelezi wanted it. And the killing was going on between these two factions constantly. And the only way to stop that killing was for Buthelezi to recognize that what he was doing was really very selfish, would hurt the whole of South Africa, and in the end would hurt himself as well. He wasn't intelligent enough to see that, because he had whites behind him pulling the strings and a lot of support from, sadly, from Britain and America. Well, through a strange set of circumstances, I knew him personally quite well, because he'd come to England long before as a young man to get some help to start a Zulu newspaper. And I had given him hospitality in the retreat house of which I was chaplain. And so I was asked to be one of those who tried to persuade him to come in from the cold, to join the South African government, and himself become a minister in a united South Africa. And that is precisely what in the end happened, and the civil war was averted. And I was one of those who was able to bring some influence to bear on him. It took a lot more than just me. There were many factors involved, of course. But it was a great privilege, having fought against apartheid for so long in so many different ways previously, to then be in on the building of a new South Africa. And, you know, that really was a very wonderful time with, you know, a great world statesman like Mandela, as it were, steering South Africa into a better future. But of course, years of deprivation, lack of education for blacks, and an economy which left most young blacks unemployed, made it inevitable that the building of a new South Africa would be a very slow and painful process. And so it's not surprising that South Africa today is still a place of tremendous violence and instability. Yes, it's democratic, all right. I mean, it's one of the few African countries that really is democratic. But the journey to a mixture of justice and prosperity is a very long one, and of course the danger of corruption and all the things that a new society being built up is there, but it's really hopeful.
There's some elections, you know, the first elections. Were you there at all?
No, I wasn't there for those elections.
You saw the films of them.
Oh, yes. I mean, it was one of the great events of the 20th century. It was really a very, very wonderful time. And I, in a way, I could wholeheartedly feel with it and, you know, rejoice at it. And that differentiated it in a way from the implosion of communism. The two did have a lot in common because, yes, apartheid also imploded in the sense that it no longer worked and the whites abandoned it in a way that was similar to the Soviet government abandoning Marxist-Leninism and, in fact, dissolving the Soviet Union. But instead of a new hope from prophetic leadership who had a vision for a just and new South Africa, what you got was the communist nomenklatura, the communist bosses, simply dropping communism, taking to themselves privately what had been state property and becoming billionaires overnight. And those who had been taught how to run a dictatorship taking power in the new system. So that you have Putin, who was a KGB officer. Actually, he was running the KGB office in what was virtually Soviet-occupied East Germany. Putin works himself up, supported by all his former KGB friends, to become the new president, and running a fundamentalist corrupt system, which has now the greatest disparity of wealth probably anywhere in the world, with the majority of Russian people becoming poorer and no longer being happy with their new gained freedom and being sentimental about wanting a Stalin back to bring order and some kind of minimal prosperity, which they had under communism, and a top elite closing down on civil liberties and this reflected in a less dramatic way in the other former communist countries of Eastern Europe. I think at least some of them will probably be able to make the transition to something like what we've got in the West, because they have a Western tradition anyway. I think the Czechs and Slovaks and the Hungarians, and in their own very different way, the Poles will probably integrate into the European Union fairly easily. Others like the Romanians and Bulgarians and the countries in the Balkans, subject to huge instabilities, how they will manage the transition, I don't know. So that Eastern Europe is in some ways comparable to the new South Africa. In other ways, it's very different.
It all happens so quickly. And knowing this area as you did, were you very surprised at that? You know, from 89, when you suddenly got people's palm, the people at Gorbachev in particular, you know, giving new messages.
I, like all the other experts, and I suppose in a minor kind of way, I regarded myself as reasonably expert about Soviet and East European conditions. Like all the other experts, I was totally taken by surprise. And there is only one man whom I dearly loved, and who is a great expert on Russia. His name was Sir John Lawrence. Who, during the Second World War, was press attaché at the British Embassy in Moscow, and who then published a British journal in Moscow, a sort of British public relations journal in Russian, until Stalin closed it down. And then he wrote a history of Russia. And then he became the president of the Great Britain USSR Association, which must be distinguished from the British Soviet Friendship Society, which was a communist fellow traveling body, but this was the government-to-government body. And John Lawrence, because he had this privileged position of being president of the GB USSR Association, was one of the few British people who spoke fluent Russian who could travel in Russia and talk to anybody. And he was part of my committee at the British Council of Churches on Eastern Europe. And he used to say to us, they've long ago stopped believing in their own propaganda. The whole thing is hollow. It is a pure power structure on economically shaky legs. I don't know why the West is so frightened of them. The whole thing is bound to collapse, and I will see the end of it before I die. And we all smiled about him and said, John, you're a hopeless idealist. And he lived to see it happen. He lived another 6 months. I think he was 97 when he died. But he was proved right. And he's the only person I know who predicted that the Soviet Union would peacefully collapse, would implode. He said, they don't believe in it. And in the long run, you can't run a system that you don't believe in. It inevitably collapses.
And I suppose in the meantime, with information technology, television, yeah, people were able to see and compare. Wouldn't
yeah.
that have been?
Well, I think, yes, I mean, well,
people like yourself visiting.
Yes, I mean, their top officials had to deal with the rest of the world. Knew, well, one, they stopped believing in the ideology. That's, you know, they really did. Everybody, I mean, that was generally accepted, except that people didn't realize that how corrupting that was. They still thought the power structures would survive. And so in a strange kind of way, the fact that they didn't believe in their ideology anymore, believed they also had no self-confidence in their own power anymore. They had an awful inferiority complex. And, you know, all their nuclear weapons and everything else didn't really help them. And so when Gorbachev came and believed he could save the whole situation, Gorbachev was not an anti-communist. He did not want to end communism. He wanted to radically reform it. And it was simply too late. And he then recognized it. You know, then he realized he'd missed the boat, you know, and he really He really did see to the end of the Soviet Union, and it is, of course, it is very interesting that in a speech not long ago, Putin said that the demise of the Soviet Union was the greatest tragedy of the 20th century. In other words, in his ideal, he wants it back, not as a communist state, but nevertheless. Putin would really like to do what the Chinese have done. The Chinese never lost confidence in themselves, even when they lost confidence in Marxist-Leninist economics. The Communist Party of China said, the only way you can run China is in a party dictatorship. So you can scrap the communist bit, still call it the Communist Party of China, and run it as a huge capitalist enterprise from the center.